This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
Now, Eli,
Yes. Today
we have the privilege of sitting down with the visionary curator and cultural advocate, Sarah Reisman. She's a trailblazer in the art world and a driving force behind some of the most captivating exhibits in recent memory. Sarah, so great to have you. So great to have you. So let's open up with a little bit about you for our listeners. Can you talk to us about your journey in the art world and what sparked your interest in curatorial practice?
So I started thinking I would be an artist. And like most aspiring artists, it's not really feasible to say, I'm an artist, it's all I'm doing. There's the kind of economic question, right,
that
always underlies cultural practice. So I came to New York in the early 90s and was working in certain nonprofits like Artist Space, which is one of the oldest alternative spaces in the United States, led by artists, founded by artists at the time. What was interesting in that moment was I started working there thinking, I'll learn about how the art world works. And pretty quickly, I could see that there was a real relationship between artistic practice and curatorial practice, meaning making exhibitions. They used to have a series called Artist Select. So when I started working there in 1997, I think it was, one of the first shows up was a solo show by Jeff Francis, an artist who I didn't know anything about at the time, selected by Cindy Sherman. Another show that was up was called Station to Station, a video kind of program curated by Gary Simmons and Tony Orsler. So they're not both video artists, but they came together around video. And for me, that was actually like an interesting connecting point. Also, I was working, this is maybe a little bit more detail than you need, but I was working with found materials, partly because they were everywhere in New York City,
right.
Like found photography, old film footage. So I was making artwork ultimately out of other people's materials, and I was conscious of that. And so a few years later, I was reading a book about Joseph Cornell, who at the time was a favorite artist, his biography by Deborah Solomon. And he was known to do film screenings at the Julian Levy Gallery that were like found footage, and I thought, that's interesting. I wouldn't compare myself to him, but what I was really interested in was he described himself as a curator of culture. And I thought, that might be a better term for what I'm trying to do, and also more honest, because then I could put artists forward rather than using anonymous material, if you know what I mean. So that was a kind of turning point around 1999 or 2000. A few years later, I did the Whitney Independent Study Program, which include like artists, curators, and critics participated, and it's a one-year kind of art, not finishing school, but it's like post-college. It's not really graduate school, so it's a kind of practice where you get to work with other curators and staff at the Whitney, and that from there, you know, the rest is unfolded.
A lot of people don't quite know what the Academy of Design is, National Academy of Design. So it'd be great to, you know, talk a little bit about its origins, you know, its history, you know, what's the significance. Of course, it's not just art, it's also architecture and design and art.
Right. So the National Academy of Design was founded in 1825 by 15 artists and architects. There's some places where it says 30,
I read that too.
And the first 15... They founded the Academy at a time when there were no art schools or museums as we know them today. Of course, there were artists. Of course, there were architects. But the sort of professionalization that we see in this moment didn't exist. So it started out called the New York Drawing Association. And it was basically a place to study drawing and then for exhibitions around drawing to happen. The first annual exhibition took place in Lower Manhattan. So it's almost 200 years old. And it's an honorary society that these... men, 15 men who set up the academy, were modeling the organization after European academies that they had seen in their grand tours and travel. So a very privileged bunch. And the academy has grown to, we have a membership of up to 450 living academicians. We call them National Academicians, or NA for short. Over the years, it has been a museum. It has been an art school. Right now, we're neither. We moved into a new space last summer in Chelsea and are kind of demonstrating a commitment to the contemporary. I think there's a perception that the Academy is like very 19th century because it follows the 19th century model. But at the moment, our main kind of programmatic thrust is that we do 3 or 4 exhibitions a year in our space. We lend work for exhibitions. We have a very vast collection, which I can talk about a little bit later. And we're an advocate for artists and architects in ways that are not necessarily financial, but
We have programs, I imagine.
We have programs. Yes, so we have exhibitions, we have public programs that accompany them. Some public programs are separate, just have to do with elected academicians and the work that they're doing that we think can, you know, would be helpful for the public to learn more about. So we still operate as an educational and cultural programming organization, but we're not officially a museum, we're not officially an art school. And I was very attracted to that when I started working for the Academy like 3 years ago. Next week.
Sounds like another set of found materials in a way.
Yeah, right? No, but it was interesting to go through, to understand. How do you get in? Yeah. That's a great question. So it's a peer nomination and peer election process. So currently there are 420 academicians, artists and architects. There's a window in the spring where they can nominate up to two or three people each, three people. So it's like 2 artists, 1 architect.
Also, it's not a lot. Jerry.
No, but the nominations end up being
2 each though. It's 450 of them.
Well, back up. It's up to 3 each. It used to be 2. We extended it to 3 to try to make it cross disciplinary. Meaning, if you're an architect, Tony, you could nominate 2 architects and 1 artist. And if Eli, you're an artist, do 2 artists, 1 architect. And the idea is just to kind of keep them conscious of the other practice because sometimes there's a split, and so the nominations end up being 45 or 50 nominations that candidates. And then there's a window later in the spring, which closed at the end of May, whereby the academicians have time to vote. Now it's all done online, which is much easier, I think.
Sure.
Yeah, so we get them to vote early, not often. yearly, that's pretty often. And then there's a whole equation about how an academician is elected.
I assume there's jurors of some kind.
There's no juror system.
No. So who decides who's in and out?
The members.
Somebody.
So I'll be technical. We have 420 academicians. 20% of them have to actively vote for the election to be legitimate, and then 60% of the votes would elect somebody.
So not everybody gets nominated gets elected.
Exactly. Okay. We're trying to strike a balance where at least half of the artists and architects shown at the National Academy are living members. We also draw from our collection, which is mostly made up of works contributed by members living and past. And so, it's sort of a political thing. It's important that the academicians are very well represented.
Sure, right,
but it's very important that we're looking outward too. Otherwise, we're a club. Right.
No, that makes
a club.
Sense.
And that's
and
not
that's something we don't we,
that makes
we
it very exclusive.
We can't
in this
be right
sense.
Now. Yeah,
sure.
Can't
any,
afford it.
Any emerging artists in there or in the mixture?
Last year in 2022, we elected 17 academicians. There are a handful of them in the group that I have admired for a long time who I identify with. Mm-hmm. Neri Ward was one of them. And Tanya Bruguera. And the interesting thing for me with both of them is Neri's very political in his work, as is Tanya, but in totally different ways. Tanya Bruguera is a socially engaged artist, does something that she developed called arte util. So it's this idea of art having political use and meaning. She's Cuban. And so to get her elected into the Academy was great. I mean, I didn't have much to do with it. We just facilitated staff. We can't influence.
Right. You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to Sarah Reisman. So wonderful to have you, Sarah. Eli, it sounds like you've got more questions.
Yeah, I got 60 pages here.
Yes.
So, but in some ways, it's really a unique animal, if you will. It's not like other institutions in many ways. Of course, it's not just does exhibits and has educational outreach and other stuff like that, but it also it's kind of like the... It's an academy to a large extent. So I was just curious, I guess the question is I guess it changes people's career paths to a certain extent, wouldn't it? By being elected or is it just acknowledgement of a...
It's recognition. And recognition can be useful or not, you know? I mean, I think for some people it's really meaningful. For some people they participate in all kinds of... They give service to the academy, participate in... selecting you know, awards for younger artists, which we do some of that. And then there's some who don't have really time to be involved, but are happy to accept the honor of being an academician. I think for some, it's like if artists, especially artists and architects who teach actively, which I think is the hallmark of a certain kind of successful career, sometimes they don't want to be involved in the committee work of the academy, and they don't have to. They can just be named, and then we can invite them to be in shows periodically or ask them to participate in certain things. But maybe for some, the recognition is all they need, and others, you know, want to get more involved and ask us for more.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, can you talk to us about one or two exhibits that you've done that were particularly meaningful during this time?
So before we had a dedicated space, we were looking at temporary spaces and worked with Governor's Island the summer of 2022. And I work with an exhibition committee of artists and architect members who advise, and they had said it'd be really great to do a show where artists and architects can be shown together because it's usually separated out. So we did an exhibition. I mostly work closely with an associate curator named Natalia Vera Salgado. So we co-organized a show at Governor's Island called Materia Material. And that was partnering with Materials for the Arts, who gave our artists, we had a residency for 6 or 8 weeks, and then building on the residency did an exhibition. And you probably know the houses on Governor's Island are in different states of disrepair or repair. And so I thought if we can do a residency first, like they can work in the space, that will actually make it more home, like more habitable for them. And then we added other artists to that show. So it was a show about creative reuse and also the kind of labor that goes into the production of material. That was just a very dreamy summer to be on Governor's Island. Yes. And another show that we did, the opening show in 2023, Drawing as Practice, was a massive show with 80, it was like 80 some artists and architects, and then 100 some artworks in the show.
Right.
And that was an interesting way of connecting with the historical artwork that we have in our collection and bringing it kind of in dialogue with contemporary drawing and the way that drawing figures into so many different kinds of art making and architecture, and that it is like the planning tool, it connects so many different ways of working, and it can doesn't always involve, you know, sort of marks on a substrate. It can also be, you know, taking a cardboard structure and like, you know, reworking it, cutting it up. I don't know. It can be collage. But it was a great experience to do that and to bring together so many different academicians and people from outside the academy.
Drawing's the oldest art form. Goes all the way back to drawing's the oldest art form.
Yeah, cave
goes
cave
back
art,
to
right?
cave drawings. Yeah. 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 It's interesting what you say about architects and artists, because I went to Cooper Union and they had engineering school and architecture school and the art school, and like we were like East Berlin and the architects were West Berlin and the engineers were like the Russians.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I know, by the way, I'm a big proponent saying that because that'll be in trouble, but I'm a big proponent of cross-disciplinary work of some kind. It's interesting to hear about that. But the other thing I wanted to ask you was about, do you also do talks where you bring in outside people to talk about topics of interest to the community? Yeah. You do that? Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think a highlight, we have a recent, our program director of programs, Ian Coffrey, recently joined the Academy last fall. And he's the staff of the Academy, and he's been organizing programs a bit differently than we had been doing. We had a really amazing talk between Sarah Oppenheimer and Torquasse Dyson, two academicians who were elected in 2023, and were in the show Sites of Impermanence. So they did a talk, and I don't know how to put it, but it's like the two of them were so like poetic and freewheeling in the way that they talked about their work. Sarah identifies as a spatial manipulator, so doing interventions into architecture that question the infrastructure of cultural spaces. And Torquasse's work is really more about the infrastructures of oppression and how architecture has kind of contributed to oppression, but then how to subvert that towards liberation.
I was about to talk to you around the whole social justice piece of your work. And, you know, what struck me in reading about the Academy was this idea of American art. What does that mean? It just seems, I don't know.
Does it seem antiquated?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, very antiquated. What is an American artist? I'm like, what the heck is that?
Well, yes, we're working.
I'm an American.
Yeah. I think we want to trouble that because, first of all, to be elected into the Academy, you don't need to be an American citizen. I don't know how broadly I should say that or shouldn't say that, but in fact, there's no real, like, nobody needs to prove citizenship. If they're active in the U.S., they can be elected, right? And it's not really if they get enough votes, they get elected, right? So, but I would like to challenge that, and we have some in some upcoming program for our 200th anniversary. We will be trying to unpack what it means to be an American institution and founded in a certain moment. An upcoming show that will be in two parts is called Past as Prologue, a Historical Acknowledgement. And it comes out of a number of initiatives within the Academy, but one is, this is a small thing, is but meaningful. We started a podcast series in 2021 when we didn't have a space and people weren't yet getting together in person. Our programs director started it, Adrienne Elise Tarver. And she and I were talking about how do we do a land acknowledgement before the podcast? How do we deal with this? And we decided together and then with input from staff, let's call it a historical acknowledgement and question our history. Like, put that forward when we welcome people. Because land is one part of the equation, right? We're working with some advisors on that show. One is Ava Diaz, who's a professor at Pratt, who's currently at the Getty Institute. And when we've talked about the Past as Prologue historical acknowledgement, she said, I want to write about the historical acknowledgement because that's the question when you think about, like, Africans who came here by way of slavery, like, what's the land acknowledgement for them?
Right.
So we're in a good position as an institution that's founded by its members to question these things we don't have like a patronage structure. We should have more of one.
So who's in the questioning though? Meaning who's participating in these conversations? What voices are being amplified?
That's a good question. So right now it's within like the curatorial department, the programs department, and then the exhibitions committee. We're bringing in some advisors from outside who will bring a diversity of perspectives. And then when the show's open, then there's space to have certain kinds of dialogue about what constitutes American culture. What is how do we acknowledge this history in a way that moves us forward?
I'm wondering, in thinking about the Academy, is there community engagement outside of your membership? How does that look? As opposed to, of course you have the galleries and the exhibitions, but is there more?
Yeah, there's more. I mean, we've been trying to build up programs since I started. There was a kind of shift before I got there, of course, to re-up the whole organization. And I can explain a little bit more about why that was, how that happened.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. And now we're going to continue with Sarah Reisman. Sarah, you were saying.
Yeah, what was I saying?
Well, I think one of the things you were talking about, this idea about, and I think it's a common topic a lot of institutions to
community engagement.
Right.
Community engagement. Right. But also to sort of reexamine what they're doing in terms of cultural appropriateness, things like that. Because it reminds me of that conversation we had with Sean Decatur, who is the CEO of
He's the president of American Museum of Natural History.
Right. And he was talking about this amazing project they did where they sort of reevaluated and redid their first American exhibit because they realized that it was all done from the colonial view, if you will, and that there were some inappropriate artifacts, for example, that were part of sacred ceremonies they had to return.
Right.
So it's interesting to hear in some ways, it sounds like that the process you're going through to a certain extent.
It's similar.
Accurate?
I mean, the Past as Prologue, what we're doing is taking a group of early works from the collection. And our collection, we have over 8,000 works, and the works have been largely contributed by academicians as part of their membership. So we don't buy the works, and that's a questionable thing. And it used to be that when you were elected into the Academy, in order to vote, make decisions, be part of anything really substantive, you had to have given your work, your diploma work. So in 2022, that requirement was lifted. And so it's, people can participate fully from the get-go. But we have this large collection. So to take a selection of works that might be considered problematic in this moment, maybe the titles are problematic. I think of Eastman Johnson, who we organized a catalog raisonné with two art historians from outside. And he was an American genre painter who was a member of the Academy and made works, portraits of women, Africans, indigenous people, Jews. Mm-hmm. And the title, some of the titles are totally offensive now. Yeah. So the question is, can we take some of those works and like connect them with contemporary works that will essentially like unpack, help us understand that history? That's something we're doing with that show.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like cultural radiation, you know.
What do you call it? Cultural
radiation.
Yeah, we're letting it radiate.
Yeah, no, in some ways, like, you know, illumination, whatever you want to call it.
But,
I
think illumination.
Illumination's great.
Okay, Sam, from Brooklyn.
But these works do radiate certain content. And so the question is, how do we can put them forward and say, this is part of our past. It's not like the most positive light for us, but it also unpacks.
Well, we're products of time.
It's a product of timepiece
that we can't lose sight of.
Right.
But what intrigued me about your, you want to
no,
say
so I want to add to that before you go.
Okay,
there.
Go ahead.
I'm
going to
say that it's an enlightened context. That's what it is.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Okay.
That was.
I like that.
Let's put that one in air quotes.
I'm going to
put that in air quotes. There you go. You will get that. Now, you were the director.
Come on, it was worth it, right?
Yes, it was. Yes, it certainly was. Now, you were working at the Shelley and Donald Rubin Foundation in social art and social justice.
Yes.
I was really intrigued by that, especially now coming into this space that you're in now. How did that practice inform what you're doing now in terms of values and things of that nature?
I love the question because mm-hmm. I think, look, in the last 5 or 10 years in philanthropy, there's pressure around social justice, but I think in certain ways that institutions, organizations are kind of shoehorning their way in, right? And I think what's great about the Academy is that it's artists and architects. Most of our programming is focused on living artists and architects. We uphold free speech in the way that we work with them. What I love about it is they're setting the kind of political agenda one by one, but it's not kind of a unanimous sort of party line. And I think in the social justice sphere, while I absolutely sincerely am invested in social justice, I can see the signaling happen in certain contexts of the art world, right? So within the Academy, that's not the main goal, isn't social justice, but the artists and architects can drive that in the way that they do their work and the way that they participate in exhibitions and show and programs. So for me, that feels more authentic to have it come from an individual perspective or a collective perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm thinking though, in terms of social justice and how the art world sometimes has difficulty explaining that, how art is entwined with social justice. Any thoughts about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that art is, it's not only an instrument of communication, but it can communicate and express ideas that are in certain environments can be very difficult to share or voice. And so I think that there's the kind of cliche of like changing hearts and minds. Art has that potential. I think there are a lot of things that can't be expressed without some level of art. And I'm not saying that the art object will tell you the thing that you need to know, mm-hmm. but I think that there is art in how we communicate, and then there's communication in the artwork. So I think that without being able to express certain ideas, what change can happen? Like if art, I think of literature, for instance, like an artist can tell a story about their own lived experience, or they can, you know, communicate an experience of a community that they're not part of, but as an ally or as, you know, in support of. That's hugely important. With visual arts, it's less concrete what is being communicated sometimes if we think about abstraction and its function and its maybe what it diffuses at times. But I still believe that there's potential in visual art and contemporary art, performing arts, performance art, literature, dance. Like you can communicate so many things that like in the literal kind of language that we have doesn't necessarily come through. And people can be connected through that in ways that they might not otherwise have access to each other.
So and you're speaking about it from empathy too, building empathy.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm. It begs also another question, because I'm sure you've run into this, especially with contemporary art. And a lot of people look at it and say, you know, what the hell am I looking at? And things like, how do you sort of bridge the gap between lay people's understanding with art, and how do you get them past that first reading to really understand what they're looking at?
I mean, my intent as a curator is to write in a way that is elevates how people understand the work, but is not alienating, right? So I will often choose, you know, more accessible language over theoretical terms, or if I use theoretical terms, I'll explain them in the writing.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
And I feel very committed to that. And that is actually in line with caring about social justice. You can't, I mean, to do work that's just for a small group doesn't, I don't know where that gets us.
You know, I once asked my sister, I had to write an artist statement, she wanted to see examples, and I sent it to her, and she called me back and said, listen, I read the first line, I want to stick a fork in my eye.
Yeah.
And they're like, what the hell are you talking about? But right. It's interesting you say that, because there's no reason why it has to be like that.
Yeah.
You know, it can't be.
And I have thought sometimes when I write, I'll think, oh, this is too plain. But what I see is that it's accessible, and that's
Hemingway's pretty plain language, so. You're in good company.
Yeah.
You know, I think I also wanted to ask you a question, and it just came to me. It's not on the list, so.
Do your
hope
thing.
This is going to
Do
go towards
thing.
My grade.
Right.
So anyways, about artificial intelligence.
Okay.
What's the discussion within the academy, academists about?
Yeah. I don't think we don't have a discussion with the academicians right now. What I'm starting to see, though, is because I teach at the graduate level, curatorial studies and a master's program at School of Visual Arts, you can see that AI is something that's coming into play in terms of writing. Right.
Image generation too.
Yes. Though I don't think I've seen that with MFA students that I've taught.
Interesting.
Maybe at Columbia in the MFA program where I'm a visitor once or twice a year, I've seen some AI play, but I think it's fairly light touch. You know, it's kind of experimental. I don't know.
In the future though, it's probably going to,
I think it's happening in ways a lot of us don't understand. I'm going to admit that I don't fully understand where is AI and where isn't it. I understand that for, is it for television or advertising? Like there's script, maybe you told me this.
I think for visual arts a lot, right. But it's interesting in some ways that a lot of the pundits and writers got it wrong because they focus mostly on the text to image aspect of it.
Right.
Right. And the problem of it that is when it gets into when you start typing in a prompt in the style of, because that borders on intellectual property. But it's a much more interesting tool when you start to blend your own stuff.
Right. So well, an
I
artist,
think that's the real power of it.
An artist I think of who's not in the academy yet is American Artist, who that's their name. And American has an artwork called Sandy Speaks, which is about Sandra Bland.
It's using
a kind of chatbot. Hmm. Something like a chatbot to communicate with Sandy, who isn't necessarily Sandra Bland, but speaks about that story.
Yeah. Check it out.
Yeah. I would like to see what something like that looks like.
I'll send you a link.
Right. Yeah.
So I once read that when you looked at what institutions like, I won't say which museum, talks about what 21st century art, they say that it's art made in our time.
Oh, right. That's the Whitney. Art
Whitney,
of our time.
Right.
Yeah.
Made in a time, not of a time, because that's a different animal.
Okay.
Right. So, for example, photography, before it was invented, you couldn't do photographic work.
Right.
So the question begs, like, okay, so what is it? What is it now? Anyways, that's another show.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your incredible journey and your insights. Your dedication to integrating art into public spaces and addressing social issues through your work is truly inspiring.
Thank you so much for having me, Tony and Eli.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Art Moves. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's Art Moves with a Z. You can listen to Art Moves on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Bricks Arts Media and recorded at Bricks Studio in downtown Brooklyn. I'm Eli Kaslansky.
I'm Tony Williams.
And until next time, keep exploring, keep creating, find some art that moves you, and share it.